Okay, well, thanks, Mark. So thanks, everyone, for coming out. This is a topic that I've been working on for quite a while, and most of what I say is an embodiment of recent work, some of it not fully completed yet, with some grad students, Laura Henderson, Roby Henegar, Keith Eng, who are PhD students here and are in the audience today, and a former PhD student, Alex Smith, who's now a postdoc at Dartmouth, and a visitor, Johnny Zhang, who is presently in China, and Eduardo Martin Martinez, who is at the IQC. So, this is a talk about how we perhaps can operationally understand what entanglement of the quantum vacuum is near a black hole and how we can actually operationally extract it. So entanglement harvesting is the phrase used to refer to the process of extracting correlations from the quantum vacuum of any field. In this talk, I'll be dealing with scalar fields, but in principle, it could be any quantum field. And the basic idea is that two detectors that are initially uncorrelated at all, let's say they're in their ground states, can, after a certain period of time, you turn them on and then turn them off, they will become correlated or entangled in a way that will depend on their relative energy gaps, how far apart they are, and on their state of motion, and on other factors that we will discuss here. And this has a number of in-principle applications in seismology, range finding, quantum key distribution, and in extracting entanglement from atoms. And these ideas have been explored in a number of papers here, some of which I've been involved with and some of which I have not been involved with. I suppose the key distribution is perhaps a more practical application than some of these other things. So, the main thrust of this talk is that very little is known about this process in curved space-time. So this is more with an eye to fundamental physics. What happens when we try to understand quantum entanglement between two apparatus in curved space-time, or two different systems, say? So how did this subject emerge? Well, Anthony Valentini, who is known to a number of people here, he was at Perimeter for a while. That's a bit too fast. He actually pointed out way back in 1991 that a pair of uncorrelated atoms that are space-like separated could become correlated via QED vacuum fluctuations. That was a paper published in Physics Letters A that didn't get a whole lot of attention. I've looked at its citations, and most of them are either incidental or, to the extent they're interested in the topic itself, really are more concerned about some basic causality properties. And then in 2003, Benny Resnick basically rediscovered this effect and quantified it in a more idealized setting where the quantum field was a scalar field and the detectors were idealized detectors. And since then, there's been increasing interest in the subject. But to my knowledge, the first time this was done in curved space was when Greg Versteeg and Nick Menicucci investigated non-local correlations between detectors that were in a De Sitter space. And then in 2011, harvesting was named as such in a paper that I wrote with Grant Salton and Nick, in which quantum field correlations, we looked at how they could be, how the vacuum correlations could be swapped with accelerating detectors. And at that point, to my knowledge, this phrase was used and it seems to have stuck. And then after that, Eduardo and another former student of mine, Eric Brown, and William Donnelly, who is back in the neighborhood again, looked at how to sustain this process. So you go from harvesting to farming, and you basically ask what you need to do to have this process become cumulative. And then finally, the more recent development is in this paper that I just put out with Laura Roby, Alex, and Johnny on the archive. It's either the last paper of 2017, or it actually appeared as the very first one on New Year's Day of 2018, depending on how you want to look at it. And we actually asked what, to my knowledge, for the first time, is what happens if you try to harvest entanglement in the vicinity of a black hole. So I'm going to try and sketch out some of this thing in particular, but a little bit more about curve space. But to give an idea of the context, the basic way you can describe this kind of system is with the action of a detector that's right here. Oh, I guess I can use this thing. That's why it's here. So you have the action of a detector right here and a quantum field, which I'll take to be a massless scalar right here, and some interaction term between them. So you can imagine putting the system in a cavity, which is what really, for practical purposes, one would have to do if you wanted to try and do this in the lab, which is contemplatable. And so you have the detector action when you convert it to a Hamiltonian, being this, just the number operator of the Hamiltonian times the energy. And you have the action for the field becoming this quantity here. But because the field in general might be in a different state of motion, for example, then you've got a time dilation factor between the proper time tau of the detector and the coordinate time t of the lab, say. And then the interaction part will become the interaction Hamiltonian. Or conversely, you could, what would that thing be? Not conversely, what would this be? Well, it's usually taken to be a linear point-like interaction between detector and field. And that is, in general, the model that is used. And there's recent work by Eduardo and I think Richard Lott, and maybe Nick Funai in another one, I can't remember, but certainly Richard, in which they point out that actually if you couple an atom to an electromagnetic field, there are broad circumstances under which this is actually a pretty good model of that kind of coupling. So Baylock Hu and Xiyun Lin have done a lot of work. I put two of their earlier papers on this, where they actually use this upper kind of model in the continuum instead of in a cavity. More recently, Eric, Eduardo, Nick, and I wrote a paper, and there was another one coming out at the same time by Yvette Fuenes, Tony Lee, and David Bruschi, where we actually look in detail at how you would formulate the cavity problem here. So the point of this is that states of quantum fields, often in quantum field theory, quantum gravity, are talked about in a very broad, idealized sense. The idea of this, of coupling a detector, is to give it operational meaning, to ask, okay, what could you in principle see with some kind of gizmo that was a two-level qubit type of state? So, of course, this goes way back to what is known as the Unruh effect, which employed geometric methods for determining how detectors in a non-inertial state of motion would behave. And in particular, in today's language, what was looked at by Davies, Fulling, and Unruh in different papers is that you had an eternally accelerating qubit coupled to a, I didn't put the word in there, but scalar quantum field. So this is a very idealized situation. No such thing ever accelerates eternally. But the advantage of that was, because of this, you get these observer-dependent geometric horizons, and it's possible to explicitly calculate Bogle-Yuboff transformations to show this key result here, that a detector accelerating for eternity at uniform acceleration will perceive itself to be in a heat bath of whatever quanta it is capable of detecting, with these factors thrown in there. So I just mentioned the limitations. It's very idealized. Nothing accelerates forever uniformly. The system is unbounded. To get the answer, it's perturbative. It's somewhat model dependent. But it has taught us that we all expect that accelerating detectors in more realistic circumstances should manifest this effect in some way. And what we would like to know and need to know to do experiments is what happens when we go to the real world where things accelerate for finite periods of time, where things are in cavities, how do we take account of boundary conditions, how do we look at quantum entanglement. So that generally motivates this study of detectors, which in particular for this talk, what happens when we do this in the context of curved space-time and try to include genuine gravitational effects?
There have been some recent papers claiming that if you generalize the Feynman idea.
Generalize?
Feynman's idea, one mass entangled with the gravitational field.
Yeah.
See the gravitational field is quantum. These people have two masses.
Yeah, that's right. That's Marletto and Vedral, and also Bose, Mazumdar, Milburn, and five other people whose names I can't remember.
It seems to me that decoherence we set in fast.
Well, we don't know. So the motivation of those papers, what John is talking about, is technically speaking, at the risk of sounding like a heretic here, we really don't know if gravity is a quantum force. We think it might be. You can give arguments to say if it's not, things are screwed up, but honestly, we really don't know. So the idea of these two papers is to try and set up an experiment where we could determine if gravity entangles things at all. And so the idea is to put two masses, this doesn't have much to do with this talk, but what the heck. You put two masses in spatial superposition, and then you let them go through a system where if the superposition is such that they are nearby, they'll be more strongly attracted than if they're in the far away case. So basically, it's like a quantum Cavendish experiment. And if gravity entangles, you will induce different phase differences along the outer paths than you will along the inner paths. And cross all fingers, maybe this is detectable. This talk here is less ambitious. I am not attempting to quantize gravity itself. I'm asking an intermediate, but I think necessary question is if you have a background gravitational field at all, what will happen to quantum entanglement? That's so it's an important thing you say, but this is, I think this is intermediate, an intermediate question along those lines.
Put some numbers in. Mm-hmm. I wasn't convinced it would work.
Well, it's not clear it will. I agree. But I'm agnostic on this at this stage. Okay? So it was, curiously enough, I'm not quite sure why the field developed this way, but after the papers in the late 70s were written by Unruh, Davies, and Fulling, lots of papers were written trying to understand effect, but almost all of them in very idealized conditions. And although the notion of an Unruh-DeWitt detector was introduced, partly due to the work of DeWitt, people really didn't ask what these things would do in other contexts. And it was about 10 years ago that Jorma Luco began to ask, okay, black holes Hawking radiate, how will a detector respond if we leave one near a black hole and keep it there? Not an unreasonable question per se. So I'm not going to review all of Jorma's work, but shortly after that, I became interested in this subject when I began to work with Nick on the entanglement harvesting idea. When it comes to black holes, Luco and Hodgkinson, Lee Hodgkinson, a former student of Jorma's, considered what a single detector would do outside a BTZ black hole, a 2+1 dimensional black hole that was static and rotating. And then those two with Adrian Ottewell wrote a paper about what would happen outside Schwarzschild black holes. Notice how recent this is. You might think someone would have done it earlier, but nobody did. And then Keith Eng, a PhD student of mine, Lee, Jorma, Eduardo, and I looked at what would happen outside Schwarzschild ADS black holes. And you can do this for a variety of boundary conditions and detector trajectories. The basic interaction Hamiltonian is this monopole Hamiltonian. Here's the scalar field. Here is the monopole operator. And this thing is what we call the switching function. So the idea is the detectors are not on for eternity. Nothing lasts that long. That you switch them on and off for a finite period of time, and that's what that is. C is a coupling constant, probably a bad choice of letter. And so what you can do for a single detector is compute the probability that it will get excited if it starts in the ground state, which is given by the product of this amplitude times this function here, which is called the response function, that is the convolution integral of the switching function with the Whiteman function of the scale, the two-point function of the scalars. And what is typically of greater interest, since you have some issues with divergences here, is to compute the time rate of change of the response function, which gives you, on general grounds, 1/4 plus this integral right here, which is basically a Mellon transform, I think, of the Whiteman function. So that's what's of interest, and I'll just show you a few results that came out in these papers. This one by Hodgkinson, Lukow, and Ottewell looked at Schwarzschild, and if you plot the response rate as a function of the energy gap of the two-level detector, you find when the energy gap is negative, you get this wavy behavior. A negative energy gap means you started the detector in an excited state, and you're asking what happens to it after, as a function of that excited gap. Positive means it starts in the ground state. Now, you might think, well, gee, nothing happens there. Well, if you zoom in on this little corner, you get these different decay rates. So yes, of course, it's not likely it's going to excite spontaneously, but not likely doesn't mean never. It does happen at some rate, and if you're in the Boulware vacuum, this is the rate. If you're in the Unruh vacuum, that's the rate. And if you're in the Hartle-Hawking vacuum, that's the rate. And they are, in principle, distinguishable. This is for a small mass black, this is for when the detector is nearby the black hole, and this is when it's farther away from the black hole. And you can see, in that case, Unruh and Boulware almost overlap each other, but Hartle-Hawking is a bit different. If you have a circular detector, by which I mean not a detector that's circularly shaped, but one that's going like this around the black hole in circular orbit, then you get similar types of curves. The waves, the oscillations are less pronounced. You still get this exponential type of decay way down here for positive gap. Notice this is very tiny, this response rate, but it's not zero. It will happen. And this is, again, for the larger radius situation. To go to the ADS case, this is the paper with Keith and Eduardo and Lee and Yorma. There was a lot of work done on this. There's a lot of results. I'm showing you perhaps the main one that actually Keith noticed originally, is that the response rate develops this very different pattern for not only negative energy, or the excited case, but also positive energy. The Boulware and Hartle-Hawking vacua overlap, but the Boulware rapidly plunges to zero. This is a log scale, not the linear one of the previous slide. The Hartle-Hawking continues. This very spiky behavior can be correlated with the quasi-normal mode resonances of the black hole. You can only see them when the black hole is smaller, notably smaller than the ADS length, which is what's shown here. It would be boring if I had a bigger one. And the peaks become higher and sharper as the hole decreases. So the response rate is telling you something about the quasi-normal mode structure of the black hole. All right, so that's detector response, but this talk is about harvesting. So, single detectors have sensitivity to space-time geometry and topology, which I showed some examples of, but could we learn more about correlations? Well, a recent paper by Eduardo and Alejandro Pozas Christians looked at flat space-time, two static detectors sitting still, So you look at how much they become entangled if they're turned on for a while, they're separated by a distance, they're not even moving. You can adjust their separation, you adjust when they relatively switch on and off from each other, relative to each other, I mean, and you see what you get. Nick and Grant and I actually looked at the accelerating case first, which I'll say a little bit about. And there is a paper by Eduardo Alex and Danny Turno that looked at detectors in identified Minkowski space to check sensitivity to topology. So when I talk about harvesting, how does that work? Well, here is the action of interest. We have gravity, a scalar field coupled to gravity, not necessarily minimally. We have that term there. If xi is zero, it could be minimal. We have the detector action, and we have the interaction, the linear interaction between the two. And when you convert this into Hamiltonian form using straightforward methods, this term becomes the monopole operator right there. And the, the switching function could be whatever you want, but we generally take it to be a Gaussian, because that gives the smoothest way of understanding the transition between the two. So technically, you could argue the detectors are on forever, but they're so exponentially suppressed once you're a few sigma away from the maximum that it's effectively zero. It's 10 to the minus 100 or something, 10 to minus something very tiny. What else? So the monopole operators are just given by this. Sigma plus takes you from ground to excited. Sigma minus takes the detector from excited to ground. And the unitary operator evolves the density matrix of the system from some initial state, which is generally taken to be the ground state of everything, both detectors and the field, to some other state, depending on what this does. And you can show, if you expand perturbatively in this coupling right here, each detector can have its own coupling. Here, I'll set them equal for simplicity. You get this X structure, not to be confused with that X, for the density matrix to order lambda squared. You can calculate order lambda to the fourth, but it's order lambda squared is enough to see what's going on, at least perturbatively. So here's that density matrix. What are these terms? Well, P sub D, PA or PB, D is the detector and it's A or B. This is the term that tells you whether or not the detector is excited, any given detector is, and it's exactly the same convolution integral with the switching function and the Whiteman function that I showed you about 5 or 6 slides ago, maybe 10 slides ago. So that's what that is. This is the, this gives the, maybe I put it up since I have the words, I think. So that tells you about local excitation. C tells you about local correlations between the detectors, and that gives you a measure of mutual information between them. I'm not going to say much about that during this talk. However, X is the interesting one. It tells you about the non-local correlations that are there. So if the quantum field has non-local correlations, it will be imprinted in the Whiteman function, and that in turn, via these convolution integrals, gives you a part of the density matrix that basically tells you about entanglement. How can you find out about entanglement? Well, it turns out for the particular setups of interest, you can, and because we have the detectors are basically qubits, you can, there's a well-defined measure of entanglement for qubits called the concurrence, which turns out in this case to be twice the negativity, and it is the largest of nothing, which means you have no entanglement, or this difference. And basically what you can see is when correlation beats detector noise, you get entanglement. When noise beats correlation, you don't. So that's the simplest way, at least in my mind, to understand this. So this is the root mean, this is like the root mean square of the noise of the detectors. The actual formulas are a bit more complicated, but I've chosen a special case to simplify them because I think this is easier to see.
Maybe
yeah.
Noise decoherence.
Sorry?
By noise decoherence.
Well, if the noise is big enough, you'll get decoherence. If it's not, then you won't. So what Eduardo, I'll just briefly review what Eduardo and Alejandro did on this slide. They had two detectors, static, and what they looked at is how the, in this case, they looked at the negativity, but it's basically like the concurrence, for two detectors separated by some distance where they were switched on and off with Gaussians, but their maximal, the time where the Gaussian was maximum could be temporally displaced, and they set the gaps equal. And you get these kinds of graphs. So this is negativity versus energy gap and temporal separation of the detectors here, or temporal separation and spatial separation for fixed energy gap. And they had lots of graphs. I just reproduced a couple to show you the idea. The binary graphs are perhaps a bit more useful. When it's red, you get entanglement. When it's gray, you don't. So we can see you get more as the gap gets larger, and you get less as the switching time separates. This dashed line is a boundary for where the detectors are space-like separated. So you can even get harvesting for separations beyond that at which light signals can travel. It's not easy to do, and in these graphs, you don't get very much. Notice this is 10 to the minus 11 in this color-coded diagram. So when you're nearby in space and nearby in switching time, you get lots of entanglement by comparison. You get less and less as you go up along these paths here, and you basically get nothing for large distance and nothing for large temporal separation. And they've got a lot of, so those are features are what I basically said. Entanglement decreases as the detectors are farther apart, no surprise there. Increases with increasing gap. Although it's unlikely you'll excite the detectors, it's more likely they'll be non-locally correlated. You get a weak dependence on the space-time dimension. They looked at 1 and 3 dimensions spatially. And you can get harvesting even if the detectors are space-like separated. They also looked at point light versus finite size detectors, and they also looked at sudden switching. You instantly turn it off, instantly turn it on. Backwards, sorry, instantly turn it on, instantly turn it off. And they found the Gaussian switching was more efficient. So one study that was done before that, actually, was something I did with Gray, with Nick and Grant, following up on the Versteeg-Menicucci paper, where what they did, Versteeg and Menicucci, was put two detectors in a de Sitter space that were space-like separated, and as the universe expanded, these detectors separated. But a person in the middle could get signals from both and determine whether or not they were correlated or not correlated. And what they found was something rather interesting that actually was what originally spurred my interest. Gibbons and Hawking showed way back when, if you have one detector in de Sitter space, you cannot tell if that detector is in de Sitter space or in an oven at the equivalent de Sitter temperature. You just can't tell. There is no way to do it. But you can tell if you have two of them, because the entanglement properties differ. So this graph here is the region where entanglement is possible within this region, where this is energy gap up here and detector separation there, initial separation, that is. So here are these things are in de Sitter space. Nick and Grant and I looked at them when they both accelerate in the same direction. That's what this means right here. So there, one's accelerating, the other's chasing it. We found that the correlations were exactly the same as you got in pure de Sitter space. If you were in thermal Minkowski space, you have a bigger entanglement region. They are qualitatively distinct. And if you add inertial detectors in vacuum Minkowski, the entanglement region gets that much larger over here. And if they're too far apart for a given gap, you get nothing. That's what that shows. The anti-parallel case, which is that one, so now the detectors are doing that, had an even more interesting structure. We had a region, what I've plotted here is, again, this is energy gap, This is separation with constants put in to get it dimensionless. The blue region is where you get entanglement. The purple curve is what you, is that curve right there. This line here is that line right there. And the dashed green is that dashed right there. You get an enhancement of entanglement, even relative to the flat space case when they're oppositely accelerating. And we had this funny region where you don't get any entanglement at all. We called that the necktie region because of its shape. We don't entirely know why this structure is the way it is, but that's what we found when you compute what the entanglement is. So, what about harvesting as a probe of topology? Well, Alex Smith and I wrote a paper when we did this for a BTZ black hole with one detector. We weren't entangling things. We had single response. But Danny, Eduardo, and Alex looked at this for a flat space without identification compared to a flat space with it, like a cylinder, for example, or a twisted cylinder at static detectors at fixed L. And what they looked at were covariance matrices, which wasn't entirely just entanglement, but they basically found you got lots of positive correlation in this region. Now the axes are reversed. This is gap horizontally and separation vertically. But basically, for small separations in intermediate gaps, you'd get lots of correlation that died out in these regions here. You got negative correlation for not too large separation. Separation's comparable to the switching width for very tiny energy gaps. In the twisted case, it was very different. You got huge negative correlation over a large region and not quite as much positive correlation. So this again demonstrated that there is sensitivity to topology. Why? Well, because the quantum vacuum is different in the identified case relative to the unidentified case, and this process can extract this entanglement, and the entanglement is distinct. So let's get to the main event, curve spacetime. I already talked about De Sitter, how correlations are distinct from what would happen if you put the two in a thermal bath. In ADS, a single detector, this is work by Jennings. Curiously enough, it wasn't until 2010 that somebody asked, what happens to a single accelerating detector in ADS? Nobody thought of looking at this, to my knowledge, until Jennings' paper. And what he found was there was a response threshold. In other words, if you weren't accelerating quickly enough, there was no thermal excitation at all. Once you crossed a certain threshold, which was basically the inverse of the ADS length, you got a temperature, and this is what it was. You can see the threshold right there. If that square root goes negative, you got no temperature. You got an imaginary temperature, whatever the heck that means. But harvesting has never been looked at. Black holes, single detector responses, yes. Harvesting, no, until now. So let's look at ADS. ADS, a lot of people here are familiar with this, probably everybody, can be described by this hyperboloid in space and time put into a flat Minkowski space that has two time-like directions. So here are the two time-like coordinates. All the others are spatial. And if you impose this constraint into this flat metric with two time-like directions, you end up getting, under a certain coordinate transformation, this metric, which is ADS in spherical type coordinates, where the cosmological constant is related to the inverse ADS length by that factor. And so in the simplest case you can draw, here are the two temporal directions and the one spatial direction. The ADS would be this hyperboloid surface in that two time-like, one space-like space. If you can formally couple a scalar field to gravity in that space-time, you get a Whiteman function that is given by this quantity here, which is 1 over the square root of the geodesic length minus a parameter zeta over this geodesic length plus 2, if you're in 2 plus 1 dimensions. This is an exact result. If you're in 3 plus 1, you can get an expression like this, but it's not helpful, and it's more practical to do a sum over modes, where you basically compute, you solve for the modes of the Klein-Gordon equation, of the Klein-Gordon field, for a Klein-Gordon equation in a constantly curved space-time. And I won't write out what the modes are. This parameter zeta cares about the boundary conditions of the scalar, either Dirichlet, transparent, or Neumann at the ADS boundary. So the idea here is, here's an M.C. Escher type of representation of ADS, big in the middle, smaller and smaller as you go out to infinity because of the way lengths rescale, proper lengths rescale. And we've got a couple here, the couple of papers that one's out, the other we're working on. So the idea is you put two detectors here. This is a spatial slice. So here's some initial condition. You turn them on, and then you wait a while, and then you turn them off. We now pause for a brief commercial. So what are the distinctions? Why are we looking at both 2 plus 1 and 3 plus 1? Well, there are some similarities. Both have constant curvature, both are conformally flat, both were using a conformally coupled scalar, but a key difference, there are two key differences. One is a technical one in which we kind of explicit, Whiteman is an explicit function of geodesic length, whereas in the other case we're going to sum over modes. In this case, Huygens' principle is obeyed, here it's not. Does this matter? Well, we'll learn. Here, the other key thing, when I get to the black hole, the BTZ black hole can be found from identifications here, making calculations much easier. Here, the black hole is not found by such means. The space is no longer constantly curved outside the hole. So now I'm just going to present the results of what we have, and this is in a paper, we're doing a paper on pure 2 plus 1 ADS that will appear, I hope, not too long from now. So we have two detectors with the same energy gap with some separation, and we work in units of proper separation, so it makes sense. We're not going to use coordinate separation. So relative to these coordinates, this is the expression for proper separation of two detectors, two point-like detectors. They'll have the same switching width. We're not going to temporally displace them. And we'll give them the same gap. You can do it for different gaps and separations and switchers, but that adds more parameters to the problem, and we want to keep it simple to begin with. So what do we get? Well, let's first look at excitation, which has been looked at before, but never for pure ADS and 2 plus 1, curiously enough. So we did that, and we find, let's see, detector B is the orange curve, A is the blue curve. For the three distinct boundary conditions, Dirichlet, transparent, and Neumann, we find that we get quite different behaviors. A is the detector that we're going to locate at the origin, and B in the origin of the standard ADS coordinates, and B is farther out from that. And we see that B and A have certainly different excitation probabilities as a function of the ADS length. That's what that tells us. And if we look at graphs similar to the type that Luco and Hodgkinson and Ottewell and so on looked at, and actually with Keith and Eduardo and me as well, here is the negative gap case where the detector is initially excited. Here's the positive gap case, which means initially in the ground state. And we get this familiar oscillatory behavior when it's excited, exponentially decaying when it's in the ground state, except for the transparent, where depending on, I forget the difference between this and this, I think it's for different ADS lengths. You can get oscillatory, but the oscillatory gets damped depending on other parameters in the problem, which I didn't write down and forgot. For small energy gaps, how does this depend, how does excitation depend on separation? Well, you've got interesting behavior when they're close together, but eventually it asymptotes to a flat rate as the detectors get farther apart. So once the AD, this is for small ADS length, this is for slightly bigger ADS length, but we saw basically this, we see this basically this common kind of behavior where you've got a decrease in excitation probability when they're close together, when one's close to the origin and then farther away out. There's just one detector there. Sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. What about negativity? Now we have two detectors, and we'll put the detector A is at the origin, B is about 0.1 sigma away, and we find now we get this peaking behavior for the negativity when L over sigma is 1. As L gets larger, this gets suppressed. So we find the entanglement grows as you get to the case where you start with zero gap, and then it declines rather sharply, but there's a peak for the negativity at omega about 0.3, something like that, depending on the boundary conditions. If you plot this as a function of ADS length, you find that everything asymptotes to a constant, and you can show this is the flat space case, but there's a peak here. And it's not quite clear to us how reliable this stuff for very, very tiny L is. But what happens is it looks like, roughly speaking, when the ADS length is on the order of the switching width, or a little bit less, you find that you've maximized the entanglement behavior. You've extracted the most entanglement you can. Here's a graph that shows negativity as a function of separation for the different boundary conditions and these parameters. And this, when you change this, you always get this kind of behavior. This graph enhances it a bit more. You see, you've got lots of negativity when they're close together. This is a measure of entanglement that's proportional to the concurrence, as I said before. So you got lots of entanglement here, but basically, eventually it dies as they get too far apart. Very consistent with the flat space study that I showed you earlier. When they're too far apart, there's just too much noise to entangle them. How much depends on, how far apart depends on which boundary condition you use, but once you're at a distance that's not much larger than the switching width, it dies. Here's the flat space limit that I said earlier. If they were in flat space for these parameters, then the excitation rate would be one constant value. This is versus, I didn't put it down there, this is versus the ADS length. That's what's along here in units of sigma. So it has only one value. Their ADS length is infinite in flat space. And this is just to compare that graph I showed you before, that you get a little less excitation once the ADS length is larger for the Neumann boundary condition. You get more for the Dirichlet, and you're very close to it for the transparent. So this is mapping out territory. Here's a two-dimensional plot for fixed L of large L. L is 20 sigma here, of negativity versus energy gap on the vertical axis, separation of B from the origin, which is where A is. Lots of entanglement here, less and less. No entanglement along in this triangular zone here, and precious little way out here, though there is some. How does this compare to flat space? There's the flat diagram, and to see them side by side, very close, very close. A little bit of difference in the size of this shape here, but the point of this is to show you that the flat limit in 2 plus 1, once L is sufficiently large, it's basically like being in flat space. The cosmological constant is tiny, so the negative constant curvature doesn't matter much. You need a small ADS length or lots of cosmological constant to see appreciable differences. One thing we found in this study is this phenomenon in the white circle right there. So here are the same graph I showed you before for big ADS length, small ADS length, and intermediate in units of sigma. These hashed lines are the no negativity zone, the death zone. We found there's an island of death, a small region like the necktie region where you don't get entanglement. And as you look at different boundary conditions, it moves around a bit, but it's always there. We do not understand why that is right now. We just observe it. Here's a zoom in of the dead zone. What we do know is that if you plot, let's take a fixed line right along here somewhere at 3.6, and you just plot negativity without regard to that maximum. It's positive here, tiny positive. Then there's a region at which noise beats correlation, and then noise loses again and correlation wins. So there's the island of death, or the dead zone, or whatever you want to call it. If you look at the correlations, what's happening actually is the excitations don't change much, but the correlations dip to a minimum and go back up. All right, let's get to the black hole. The idea here is the setup is we have this black hole, and we're going to put one detector here and the other one farther away. A will always be the one closer to the black hole. Without loss of generality, we can assume it. And we're going to look at a 2+1 black hole for reasons I said before, is that it's the easiest case for a conformal scalar field to compute the Whiteman function. So this is the familiar non-rotating BTZ metric, where F is given by this function here, L is the ADS length, M is the mass of the black hole, and this quantity is the proper distance detector A is from the hole. This other quantity is the proper distance of B from A. We do everything in units in terms of proper distance. So this is in this preprint we put out, or archive paper, I guess, used to be called preprints. So here's what we get when we run it through that formalism I showed you about 10 or 15 slides ago. Here is the concurrence versus separation of the detectors. As you expect, the farther apart they are, the concurrence drops, eventually dying out depending on the size of the gap. Small gap, it dies first, medium later, bigger gap even later for these parameters right here. So that's not surprising. You expect entanglement to die off as B. So A is at a fixed position, one unit of sigma. You're pulling B farther and farther away from fixed A, and of course the correlations between them, the non-local ones, die off and you don't get entanglement. So harvesting isn't possible at large separations. No surprises there. We studied the death zone, and this is where we got what I think is a more interesting result. This is a plot of concurrence versus what happens as you bring detector A closer and closer. So in this picture on the left, the black hole, let's say, is here. A is here, B is there, but now you do this. So you keep the separation, proper separation between them fixed, and then you move A closer, which means B gets closer too, and we see that black holes kill entanglement. Here we've got concurrence, but when you get too close for small gap, no entanglement. When you get too close for medium gap, no entanglement. When you get too close for big gap, no entanglement. And you can plot the death zone, or the edge of the death zone, as a function of gap for, here's a 0.8 proper separation of the detectors, the green line, one unit of sigma, the purple line, and 1.2 units. And we see that depending on how far apart they are, whether it's like this or like this or like that as you move them in, you get an optimum value. So if you want to live dangerously, if you optimize the gap of the detectors for a given separation, you can get, there's a closest distance of approach you can get, which is this minimum right here. Here is a plot of concurrence versus energy gap for these same three separations for a fixed, let's see. So, well, I'll get to that in a minute. So the first one means you better keep a safe distance. The second one means you can optimize the closest approach. And the third one means if you keep at a big distance, far away, so now the detectors are way, way out here, then you can maximize concurrence as a function of gap. So those are some of the main findings. The first one perhaps is a bit surprising. If you're too near a black hole, you inhibit entanglement. Why? Well, either the detectors are getting too noisy, or the correlations are getting killed, or both. And in fact, the answer appears to be both. When you have a small energy gap, notice as you bring the detector A close in, the excitation rate hardly goes up at all, but the correlations die off rapidly. So there's where sudden death is. That's the death zone. Too close, no entanglement. But as the gap grows, the excitation or the noise gets bigger. In fact, really big for big gap. And the correlations, they still die, but not nearly as much. Not nearly as much. So it's a combination of two effects. One is Hawking radiation. The closer you are to the black hole, the more it Hawking radiates, making the detectors noisier. But redshift effects are necessarily involved in this thing. What we did remember is I took two detectors from a factory that had equal gaps, equal switching widths. When I put them in the black hole environment, the nearer one has different redshift, gap redshift relative to the farther one, and therefore, and that affects X, and that effect necessarily erodes correlations. It's inescapable unless you want to engineer your detectors to compensate for the redshift gap, a redshift effect. Furthermore, as these three graphs show, the competition is sensitive to gap size. Here it's because correlations die out a lot. Over here it's because Hawking radiation is overly exciting the detectors. All right. We've looked at the mass dependence, and we find for large mass, the sensitivity is very low. Once you're bigger than one, all the graphs look the same. But as you shrink the black hole mass, you get this behavior like so, where the region of death moves outward, and then moves outward to here, reaching for very tiny mass. It goes way out here. Furthermore, the correlations drop as a function of the mass. We're still studying mass dependence in more detail, but those are some preliminary results we got. Here's another thing we can do, angular dependence. You can take two black holes, keep them at two detectors, keep them outside the black hole, but put them at different angular separations, keeping the proper distance fixed. So basically, here's the hole, here's A, let's put B at various places around A and see what happens. Well, what happens is this. The red curve is when B is farther from A, right? So here's A, B is out here, this is the red part, this is the blue part. Always the proper length is fixed. So we do get an angular dependence on the correlations between the two. Notice they're not farther apart from each other in any of these diagrams. It's only their proximity to the hole that changes due to the angle. For tiny gap, this is what you get. For bigger gap, you find the bottom curve. When B is closer, correlations drop. And when you have gap equal to one, you find you get an enhancement of correlation, of concurrence, when B is farther, and a depression there. The vertical axes are changing in scale, just so you can see that, 0.08 there, then 0.15, and then 0.2. So don't be misled, the axes are not all at the same scale as I march through these graphs. Here's another thing we've done. You can actually try to encompass the black hole like this and go all the way around. Here we've done it for 32 sigma of separation, where A is one sigma. It's almost at the horizon, but not quite. And what you get is this. You find the concurrence peaks at theta equals zero and then falls off rather rapidly till you get killed when the minimal path is going to go through the black hole, and we're not quite sure how to calculate that, so we don't. All right, I've only got a few minutes, so I'm going to spend the rest of it on 3+1. This is work with Keith and Eduardo. So now we're looking at ADS. And what was done there is to keep a detector in circular motion about the other, the first one being at the origin of the ADS space. So here are the parameters. Why is this a good thing to do? Well, if you do this, you get rid of redshift effects, because the redshift and the angular velocity turn out to be independent of this separation for this particular type of motion. You can consider switching displacements of tau. That's something we're doing in this study. keep the width and the gap the same for each. And these are calibrated with respect to the coordinate time measured of the detector, the T time, which happens to be tau if you're in this kind of motion. And we're just looking at one condition, the Dirichlet. There's an interesting analytic result that Keith noticed, namely the X term can be expressed as a sum of local correlations where the gap is assumed to be negative for one of the detectors and then symmetrized. Here is a reminder of what these formulas look like. In 2 plus 1, it was a convolution integral of the switchers with the Whiteman. Here, it's a convolution of the mode sum with the switchers for both C and X. And this result follows from manipulation of those two expressions. So here's what you get. Here is a plot of detector excitation, where dark means not much excitation, bright means more excitation. So we're getting excitation for small ADS length and small negative energy gap, actually, as it turns out. So if you zoom in on that bottom region right there with the red square, you see these kind of striations for negative gap. Not much excitation lots, not much lots, not much lots. We're still trying to understand the origin of what that is. It's, I think, related to the quasi-normal mode structure. No, there isn't the black hole, sorry. It's related to the, I think, a kind of resonance structure in ADS. I got ahead of myself. Here's the entanglement between two detectors, or rather the negativity between two detectors. Here, there's basically almost no negativity. Over here, there is some negativity. So ADS length is increasing on the vertical axis, separation on the horizontal axis. And if I enlarge that red square region, you don't get too much interesting structure in this case. There's sort of a cliff region where you got lots of negativity and then basically it drops almost to nothing pretty fast. What about the dependence on the gap? Well, here it is for a particular small ADS length. Negativity plotted as gap on vertical, distance horizontal. This triangular region means you get no entanglement at all. Here you get tiny amounts, and here you've got the most you're going to get in that small separation, small to medium gap region. Here is another graph with a different ADS length that I forgot to label, but the purpose of this is to show you that in ADS, yes, this is the line of space-like separation, and if it's out here, you can still harvest entanglement. The white region, actually, in this diagram is no entanglement whatsoever. There's a dependence on the time shift parameter, which we're looking at. And for ADS length sigma, you get lots of negativity when the shift is zero, decreasing as the shift goes positive or negative. One detector turns on earlier than the other, or it turns on later. And for a bigger ADS length, this structure becomes more interesting. This wedge here in this zone, you've got space-like separation. Not much, but a teeny-weeny bit of entanglement. There's a graph of the mutual information, but I didn't discuss that much, so I think I'll just go to the summary since it's basically out of time. So entanglement harvesting, as I said before, is an operational means of probing the quantum vacuum in any space-time. In other words, the vacuum has correlations. Vacuum of any quantum field has correlations. This gives you a means of extracting them in a measurable way, in principle and maybe even in practice in future experiments. What we're doing is the first efforts to understand this in curved space-time, modulo Versteeg and Menicucci's de Sitter result. It's similar to flat space-time in a number of ways. For example, when the detectors are far apart, entanglement drops. That's a general universal feature, one you expect. But we find as the curvature scale gets tiny or the cosmological constant gets large, you get significant dependence on curvature, and you can even get entanglement dead zones that we still don't understand, these islands of zero negativity. But perhaps the key take-home lesson here is that black holes inhibit entanglement. There is a competition between enhanced local excitation and the erosion of non-local correlations due to redshift effects. Although we did it for a conformally coupled scalar for the BTZ black hole, we think this is going to happen for any black hole. In other words, we expect this by and large to be a universal feature of black holes. Of course, this remains to be tested for other black holes, but all black holes will have Hawking radiation that will tend to enhance this. All black holes will have redshift effects that tend to erode that. So we expect that, unless you can think of very screwball black holes, that this will be a universal feature. I'll stop here. Thanks for your attention. Yeah.
Seems to me one interpretation tied with quantum mechanics is you just do it in the help of space. There's no space-time dependence. So it doesn't matter how far apart the detectors are, entanglement is never zero. Experimentally, this seems to be the case up to now. There's no diminishment seen in entanglement as you...
I'm not sure I understand the setup you're thinking of. What, under what circumstances would it never care about how far apart they are?
Well, see, the space-time dependence doesn't come in the quantum mechanical situation.
You mean if you entangle two states?
Yeah.
Well, this is a different question that also has not been explored. The idea here is you start in the quantum vacuum of the field, and then you ask, the quantum vacua have non-local correlations. You're asking, how can you extract them, and if you try, in what way do you do it? You're asking the question, what if we start off with some entanglement? What will happen? And the answer is, not been studied. So I can't answer that. But that's a different question than what we're asking. It's a good one to ask. It's just, you know, there's only so many grad students per unit volume, per unit time, per unit dollar, per unit whatever, right? And me. Yeah.
I guess you could ask, can you make a guess of what would happen?
Well, I would expect that's a good question. I would expect there would have to be some dependence on the space-time and the entanglement, because even though you've got, you know, if you entangle two different energy states in some way of identical detectors, they're going to know about quantum vacuum fluctuations, and it's got to have some effect. What it will do, well, it'll probably... I think these features will be inherited in some way, but it's not immediately obvious how they will be inherited or what they will do. I think, John, most of the things you're saying, people haven't worried about them in curved space-time, but it doesn't mean they shouldn't. I just don't think they've paid attention to it.
Well, our paper on satellite experiments should answer whether there's any diminishment in the type of satellite to Earth. I suspect there is.
Well, I'll take a look. I can't answer, as I said. But I think what's going to happen, my guess to answer your question, is that the features, if you're near a black hole, the features at the bottom will be inherited. If you're just in some curved space-time, it will do it. But again, all of these, we're studying it in the simplest curve settings possible, right? Because this is complicated enough, trust me. But eventually, of course, I think more and more studies will be done. When the curvature is not constant, I think other features could very well emerge.
Questions? All right, let's thank Rob again.
Okay.